We're a small, scrappy nonprofit startup consisting of like 20 volunteers. It's clear that we don't have the resources that the big players do have. But that is, at the same time, this constraint is also our biggest strength, because it means we can innovate. And we want to innovate by showing what could be possible if we optimize for, you know, healthier tech.
Welcome to Hello 5050 World, the podcast where we break tech bubbles before they break us, and where we talk to people who make tech more humane. In this episode of the Hello 5050 World podcast, I'm excited to be talking to Vardon Hamdiou. Vardon is a dear friend and someone I know for multiple years already now. He's also been at our meetups, and he is an expert in social media and how it affects society. Vardon is the co-founder and executive director of Sparkable, which is a nonprofit that builds a healthier social media platform. In our conversation, we talked about interaction patterns and why they make us addicted, for example, the Duolingo bird. And we also talk about the impact that social media has on us as a society. Vardon also brought a guest, so stay tuned for the conversation. So welcome, Vardon, to the Hello 5050 World podcast.
Thank you.
Well, start with the first question. How does your own life and path relate to making tech more humane? Is there a word or like an anecdote that comes to mind when you hear humane tech?
Yeah, I think there's two parts to that. So I grew up sort of between cultures. So I've always been, you know, in between worlds and sort of became a bridge builder at an early age. But I, over time, realized how tech is shaping relations between communities as well. And that was partly my family background, but also my work with refugees that really shaped or made me think a lot about how certain communities are portrayed in media, or talked about also especially on social media, and what it is like to meet members of that community in real life and, you know, have real life interactions. I worked in the communications team of one of the Swiss federal consulars for a long time, and in that job also consumed a lot of media every day, and sort of, I think, was exposed to much more media content than the normal person over the span of half a decade. And it was really sort of at the same time, these experiences working with refugees, but also working in this communications team, doing that job and being exposed to so much media. And I think these conflicting experiences at the same time was what really made me think a lot about how media works and how the incentives, the business incentives behind it work, and especially, you know, how technology also amplifies certain things. So I'm sure we're going to talk about like platform design and platform incentives. But I think this was really sort of the personal background that I came from to these topics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm very excited about our conversation today on media and especially social media afterwards. But before we dive in, you brought a plus one. Who is it and why is she here?
Yeah, so her name is Sofia Kaminska, and I brought Sofia today because I'm coming sort of more from a platform incentives, like structural design sort of perspective, and Sofia has more sort of the behavioral background. Sofia has done amazing work also during her master's in Lucerne, where she basically built a project that is called Option Control and did a lot of like research. And I'm sure that Sofia is going to share later a bit more on that work. But I felt like it's sort of perfectly complementary to the perspective that I'm bringing. So I'm super happy that you joined today, Sofia.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome, Sofia. We're also super happy to have you here. And we're going to dive into this topic of social media now a bit with both of you. So as you both know, social media platforms, they're engineered and designed for attention. And often we see these interaction patterns in social media that are drawing people in and really try to keep them on the platforms as long as possible. there's like prominent examples that most people are aware of, like the infinite scroll. Funny anecdote, the person that invented infinite scroll, Asa Raskin, he actually famously said he really regrets inventing this because he realizes the impact it has. But there's also other kind of funny examples like the Duolingo bird that is really making you guilty about not using the app. So these types of interaction patterns, which are the worst that you have seen in your own work or also using social media yourself? Can you share some examples with us?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think it's not necessarily just one sort of feature. For me, it's really the algorithm, specifically engagement-based algorithms. I think they are such a central sort of part of why we see sort of the harms we're seeing with, you know, polarizing, sensational content being ranked more highly and you know, everything just being much more geared towards outrage or any other like emotion. And it definitely stems from the business model where like platforms do have an incentive to keep us on their platforms for longer so they can show us more ads and make more money. And the way to keep us on the platforms longer is by showing us content that is often very borderline or like sensational, polarizing or outrageous, etc. So I really think the algorithm question is the key. And then of course, you know, there's things that tie into that, like, for example, these variable rewards. So you never know what comes next in the feed when you scroll. And the platforms also work with that, right? They don't show you only sort of the content they know for sure you're going to like, but they also every now and then sort of put content in there that, you know, just brings in that sort of variable reward aspect. And it's the same principle that you have behind slot machines. And it's just like these kinds of psychological, almost like tricks that are built into these platforms that I think it's not just one sort of feature that makes platform unhealthy, but it's like a collection of things that when you put it together, it really becomes a toxic cocktail.
For me, the most dark patterns are not that manipulative. They feel really normal in 2025, 2026. And there are lots of them, like scene feature. We're just accustomed to see when our messages are read. And they're so engraved to this human-to-human communication that keeps us addicted. Like the user is choosing the sticker and you're like, okay, which sticker they're gonna, like you are really waiting as at the slot machine, like what is gonna come next? When you refresh the feed, then it could be refreshed in a millisecond. But it makes you wait with this animation feature to just keep you anticipating the next big thing. And then, yeah, it was guilt tripping with Duolingo. Yes, they use their patterns. In the end, we also sometimes need to ask what's the end goal of them. So with Duolingo, it's in the end learning the language. There are different platforms that you can use. Yes, sure, they have the best marketing, the most popular, the most hype. That's why you can also appreciate that. That's why I use their services. And I know that. And at one point when the life is normal and you just receive this notification, you're actually happy. You're just like, okay, I'm going to do my Duolingo streak. Streak is the other pattern that they could use, the fear of losing the streak. It also guilt trips you. But on the other side, I use Duolingo as a good example for some of my design fellows because you could use their approach to streaks in real life. Like most of us have this, like, I'm going to develop a habit, but then one day you're off and you're like, okay, I'm going to forget about this. But then they have this freezes and everything, they gamify everything. And I think these all topics are just engraved in our lives, like gamification of everything. So there are lots of dark patterns that are engraved. But then I think the ones that might be the darkest and the influence on us are the ones that really feel normal.
I personally hate Duolingo. And it's exactly because of the interaction patterns and because I have a bit of knowledge on behavioral psychology and how this is built into tools. And since I know what they're using, and I even looked at a study, I cannot use it anymore. I cannot unsee it. And I think this is also the thing that you mentioned, Sophia, that these things that become normal or also that we're not aware anymore, we're just accustomed to them, these are the difficult ones, right? And I also want to touch on some good examples or also good platforms. So not everything's bad. Also in the social media space, there are positive examples. I'm going to mention one that I've recently learned about. For example, on Pinterest, they know they have a lot of users that are at school, kids, teenagers, And I don't want to draw them into using the app while they're being at school. So they have features and functionality to basically detect when they're opening the app while being at school, and they show them kind of a push-up notification, are you sure you want to use Pinterest right now, to snap them out of this habit, right? So this is a positive example. Do you have other positive examples when it comes to interacting with social media?
It's honestly difficult for me to like point to something. I didn't see that pop-up notification yet. But I know that I think TikTok also did work on something like that. If they detected that you're sort of scrolling at night, they would show a pop-up, which is definitely probably a step in the right direction. But to me, it oftentimes feels like it's just so inadequate, right? You build a product that is like fundamentally doing one thing, and then you have a little drop of the other thing. It doesn't make a huge difference. I think if you were really serious about people feeling better after they've used your product, like, you would think about why you need those interventions in the first place. Why do you need sort of an intervention that tells people, hey, are you sure you want to use our product? Like, ideally, you have built something that you know is not just like effortless and easy to use, but actually really helps people and helps not only individuals, but also society work better. Yeah, that oftentimes it's just hard to combine that with a profit motive.
Vardan, you touched on the algorithm before. Do you think if the algorithms would be different, it would make a difference?
100%. That's also why we focus so much on that with Sparkable. I really think that the algorithm is one of the central pillars. It's not the only thing, but we at Sparkable, we're looking at something that is called bridging algorithms. And it's like, it works differently from engagement algorithms or engagement-based ranking, such as, or as we know it from today's platforms, the big ones. And bridging algorithms really, in my opinion, are one of the things that give me most hope, because I really, really believe, and there's also now more and more studies on that, that they can make a huge difference. People used to sort of compare engagement-based ranking in studies with like chronological feeds or like reverse chronological feeds, but where you just see sort of the newest post at the top. But I think that is really inadequate. And so bridging-based ranking or bridging algorithms, in my view, really are something that could help make social media much, much healthier.
So can you share a bit more about Sparkable and how it works compared to other social media platforms in detail?
Yeah, so Sparkable is currently a group of volunteers trying to build healthier social media. And we have sort of four central pillars in our theory of change, four things that we believe need to be different to make social media healthier. And probably most important one is that we believe healthier social media needs to be not-for-profit. And so as an organization at Sparkable, we are a nonprofit. That's also why we are a group of volunteers. We would like to, in the future, you know, be funded by donations. We already have some people donating, but we're still very much at the earliest stage. But bringing that funding model of like Wikipedia or Signal to social media and really ensuring that our mission also financially, our mission sort of is building healthier social media, and our financial incentives should align with that. So being a nonprofit is one of the four key things for us. The next one would be bridging algorithms or bridging-based ranking, where we really believe that this could make a huge difference. Instead of ranking content based on popularity, we plan to rank content highly only when it manages to sort of bridge divides or manages to be seen as high quality by people who normally don't have the same opinion. And that is a central principle that we're trying to implement. And then the third one would be pro-social design. That is a complicated word for just like design that basically brings out people's best sides. So instead of having, you know, for example, the angry reaction option, as you know it maybe from Facebook, replacing those reactions with more pro-social options. So in Sparkable, you can't like content, you can only spark it. And when you click on the spark button, it asks you, you know, what the content sparked in you. And then you have the choice between saying it sparked insight, compassion, inspiration, joy, hope, and respect. And we chose those intentionally because it is through design, I think the platform communicates what it values and what it's looking for. So being a nonprofit, using bridging-based ranking, pro-social design, and then the last one would be transparency and user control. So really ensuring that when you use the platform, you always know why you're seeing what you're seeing. So you don't have this sort of slot machine thing, but you are in control and it's not the feed that is controlling you. And to be specific, that means that you could at any time, like basically look under the hood and see what filters are set, what keywords are being searched for, and which keywords are excluded. And you could at any time also change those settings to change what you're seeing. And I really think that this one is crucial for building shared reality, which I believe is super important for functioning societies, common ground, etc. And, you know, we don't have that today. Today on social media platforms, if you and I search for the same term, we're going to see wildly different results because it's hyper-personalized. And we want to get to the point where if two people search for the same thing and they set the same filters, they are also going to see the same content. And that should hopefully help, you know, build common ground.
Super cool. Also, the awareness piece, right, that we talked about before, this transparency that the user knows what is actually shown to them. Definitely. Sophia, you want to jump in?
I want to ask, do you have a problem that users stay too long on the platform? Do you have to tell them, like, hey, that's the time to stop?
Not yet. Not yet.
But I think that really speaks to the design, because you're not designing the product that has to have on a package, hey, like, you're going to have a attention span cancer, quote unquote, because you're not creating the product that's intentionally addictive. And on the things like, as you mentioned with funding, I think building something humane in the world that we are living in that really incentivizes this attention-based economy is really hard, because we're not sold the products there that much. When you think about the apps that actually you just go and do the things and then log out, these are not the ones that are using your attention. Like, if you think about the economics and what in the end is the goal with, I don't know, SBB app, I just thought that which product is actually having like nice nudges when I use SBB for writing from one point to another and then I forget to use to turn off the easy ride. It's like, did you arrive at the destination? Yes, okay, I can switch it off. But then in the end, the product of SBB is selling me tickets and providing the transportation. When you go to Instagram or Facebook or any kind of social media, they are selling our data. And for them, we are the product, not even the ads that we are seeing. Yeah, they have some profit from that. But in the end, the more we spend time on the app, the more we engage in that, the more data they have to sell to the ad providers. And that's how they get their money. That's the main line that we can draw between the services that we are using, who can actually intentionally bring us joy or functionality, and the others that are using our biologically engraved mechanism for thriving for the attention and connection, and then abusing them for the profit of the others.
Yeah, very good point. I was also wondering, because Sparkable is not just an idea, it's actually live, right? People are already using it. I'm also using it myself. Who do you see using Sparkable and what are their incentives? Like, why do they use Sparkable?
Yeah, I mean, that is sort of a big thing that we still work on hard. Like, I think nobody nowadays wants to use yet another app or switch. I think the switching cost is really high, and especially with social networks, if your entire network is not already on that platform, you don't have a lot of incentive to switch. So what we see for now is the people who are using Sparkable are really the ones who believe in the vision and the ones who also know about the harms that today social media is creating. So they have sort of their own intrinsic motivation to switch. And it's not like some external motivation that makes people use Sparkable. And I think ultimately we really want Sparkable to be also the place where people gather, like people who come from all different kinds of walks of lives and parts of the world, but who are sort of united in trying to build something better. Because you can build the best product, like if the community is not on board or does it their own thing, like very differently, that's ultimately, you know, going to have a huge effect as well. So I think we've been very lucky to have so many people really across the globe use Sparkable, but also contribute in other ways beyond just posting on the platform. You know, people who end up volunteering in our team, volunteering their time. Like, to me, that's the most magical thing, right? And those folks who are in the team is oftentimes like very, very similar to the people who are using the platforms or like the community at large. It's people who care about the effects the tech is having on people, on societies, on the planet, and trying to make a change, trying to make a positive difference.
So you're basically building a community of change makers at Sparkable.
That's the goal.
Sophia, are you on Sparkable?
Yes, I actually registered right after our talk that we had a couple of days ago. And we also talked about the vision and the mission and why would people be there and interplay between the stakeholders in the whole social media interaction field. And for me, when I learned about Sparkable, maybe I'm just talking from the research perspective, that was a really great way to not compete with Instagram, not for the attention, maybe yet the users can switch and like have the other space where they can have a different feeling of using and sharing and having back the feeling of community. For me, it's a really good example. How can you design a different architecture? There are lots of research being done. And then how can you transfer the research to the actual product that people can use to solve the problem? And for me, Sparkable is a great example of that, that you also can use with the stakeholders like policymakers. You can give an example on how can it be built different? How can you also see the research of people use the different kind of architecture? This is for me why Sparkable is such a big thing, not when people compare it to the user base, but to the example of how the things could be done differently, how the people who are using it would feel. And then, yeah, it goes away, all the way to the research, to the policies, to everything you can just learn by using.
Mm-hmm. Maybe touching on that, Vardon, what's the goal with Sparkable? Or when do you think you've reached success? Like, is it the number of people on the platform? Or what's your actual goal?
Yeah, no, I also say that to the team all the time. It's not like we're not optimizing for like growth. We really want to have an impact on the discussions. And I think that's why what Sophia just said is so important. Like, we are a small, scrappy nonprofit startup consisting of like 20 volunteers. It's clear that we don't have the resources that the big players do have. But that is, at the same time, this constraint is also our biggest strength, because it means we can innovate. And we want to innovate by showing what could be possible if we optimize for, you know, healthier tech, if we really have this mission at the front and center. And that means, to be really like concrete and specific, if we build things like pro-social reactions, we want to shape the discussions that are happening at the moment, because I think this topic of healthier tech, or also social media and the effects that it's having on societies, it's something that people almost everywhere, like everywhere I've been, this has been a topic that people think about. And Sophia also has mentioned, there's regulators, there's researchers, there's so many different stakeholders who have a much, much higher interest in that now. But oftentimes what is lacking is, as also Sophia said, is concrete examples of how things could be done differently. And that's what we want to contribute to as a team. We want to contribute new ideas, innovative new approaches that we can, because we're so small, we can quickly test and iterate on. And with that, sort of ideally influence the larger discussions. And also, you know, one part of the theory of change is that by contributing to discussion, our ideas and innovations, if that ends up, you know, being something that people really appreciate, then it might also be lever of pressure that you could use on the bigger platforms to make them, you know, change some of their designs as well.
And with future generations being on the horizon, being much more aware of this, like the unhealthy side of social media or technology in general, how do you feel that these digital natives, for example, the Generation Z, are using technology? Are they using it more mindfully, or are they actually much more prone to being pulled in and getting addicted with technology?
I'll let you go first, Sophia.
I have a lot to say on that. The actual talk that we've made 2 days ago was called How to Design for the Most Aware Generation. This is how I referred the people I interviewed and did the research the most while doing option control project. I worked mostly with Zillennials, which are the micro generation between Millennials and Zillennials. It not really depends on the age, but the way that they were brought up with technology. And I'm representative of that. I was born the year after Google. And then during my life, I could see how technology was changing and shaped, how it shaped my interactions, and then how my relationship shifted. So it was really drawn from the personal experience. And then as a daughter of a sailor, for me, internet brought the ability to talk to my dad, who was away for half of the year, first through the emails, then through Skype, then through messengers. And then now it's just, he has an internet on the ship. I can message him anytime and then we will be connected. He just calls me whenever, like I'm at work or at school. And then for that, for connection, that the thing that actually brings us all to social media in particular, to have this connection, it's the positive thing that I also saw in the research. But then also we're working in the social media, I could see how can you be drawn to the algorithms and overusing. And then I became this power user myself. When people would ask me, hey, you didn't post anything for 24 hours on stories. Are you doing fine? Not as a joke, but seriously. And that brought me all the way to my research I did on option control and the people I worked with. Because in the end, Gen Z and Zillennials in particular are the most aware on what technology is doing to them. If you tell them dopamine loop, they would not ask you what is this. They know what it is. They know their screen time. They're proud of their screen time. They're really sarcastic about it. The thing is, the problem is not awareness. That's the agency. How can you deal with that? I think these generations that we're mentioning, especially, I don't know the letters anymore, Alpha also coming up, they know the problem, but then the question is, how do you deal with that? And that's the thing that I think we both work on. I work more on behavioral side, Vardhan is in architectural part of it. We tried in all of the discussions to divide people either, especially on a Gen Z example, either they are perfectly adopted to this or they are completely lost. In the end, I would say that new generations are aware. They just lack some good agency or behavioral changing patterns or the different architectural of the app on the apps. And they're also the change makers. I chose especially this generation because they will raise the new generation that's going to come in and educate them. And also they're the ones that have the influence on their parents and grandparents. Because in the end, they are not the most vulnerable ones. They know it. The most vulnerable ones are the ones that are coming to the world, that are using the tech from the early age and not having any guardrails. And also the seniors who also don't have the capability and ability to educate themselves in the way that we were educated. So I think choosing the people who are the most aware is the key also in educating the other, the most vulnerable generations. And in the end, it's a complicated and complex question, but it's the most interesting to work with these people because they would be the most sarcastic. They tried it all. The blocker apps, the locker devices, and they're like, just leave me alone, let me have my phone. Or, yeah, I know I watch YouTube for a long time, but it's just the way it is. And then tapping into this space where it goes deeper on the personal and social level, when they're fine with their usage, but they're just not okay with how does it make them feel. And there's the place where you can work with and talk to people and then create some projects out of this. Because in the end, people just want to communicate and they like some spaces for having this natural way that we've done it before. So the nostalgia of Facebook and Instagram when it was all about your friends. But then in the end, it's all about being in the same room and being able to talk to each other.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely a generation that feels this social responsibility around using technology. I mean, I'm also a millennial, so I definitely feel that. I want to ask a bit of a provocative question here, especially to Vardhan, because you're building a tech product to solve a tech problem.
How do you deal with that?
It's definitely something that comes up, and I think we oftentimes like think of things as either or, and I think that's a trap because for me, the reality is we live in a world that does have a digital aspect. So we do have the internet, we do have phones, and yet we also obviously have a physical world. And those two things exist, and I don't think we need to like believe that the digital part goes away and we only need to be offline from now on and not have phones. Like, I don't think that's realistic. But at the same time, that doesn't mean we should only use tech, right? So I believe like there should be sort of a symbiotic relationship between tech and sort of real life, or call it whatever you want. But the question for me is like, if we have technology, and we do, then the big question is, how do we design it? And is it working to the benefit of individuals and societies, or is it benefiting basically a handful of billionaires, to be frank? And I think that's sort of the question to ask. How are we designing our tech, and not like, should we use any technology or at all? Like, I think there's great value in going offline, great value in not using your phone for certain periods of time. But it's also a reality that it's a privilege that many people can't do, because maybe their, I don't know, businesses rely on a technology. Like, it's so incorporated in everything we do in our everyday lives that I think we don't have to sort of, yeah, put the responsibility on the individual and tell them you need to abandon all tech. If you want to do that, sure, that's great, you know, go ahead. But we shouldn't put people in that spot because the tech that we have is so bad. I think if that's the problem, then we need to make sure that the tech we have is better and healthier. And I think that's sort of the way I approach this question.
I wouldn't say that the tech is bad. I think it's too good, so it makes us bad, but it creates the bad interactions.
Yeah, it's definitely the question of how you define good and bad. But I meant like bad in the sense of, you know, the harms it's creating. So harmful would have been a better word, yeah.
Yeah, the impact on the individual.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the individual, I'm also curious, you are both hyper aware of all the things that social media does to you. How are you using it yourself, or how has your usage changed based on what you've learned over the years?
For me, I mean, with Sparkable, it's something that we're really trying to, there's this word I don't like, dog fooding, but really using sort of the product you're building yourself. So that's definitely a big part. But apart from that, the only social media platform I use regularly is LinkedIn, because that's the one where I still feel like I can connect with people, not through the feed, not through posts, but just by connecting with them. And if, you know, there is a need for something, then, you know, it's great to be able to message people. So LinkedIn has been sort of, has opened doors for me in that sense. But unfortunately, they're also a billionaire-owned product that is, you know, sustained by ads, and as such has the incentive to make the feed, you know, addictive. And I really try to not use the feed and not look at it at all. So if I use the platform, I just use it to mainly sort of, yeah, direct message other people.
Yeah, I think with Barden, we also share some background on working with social media. So when I was growing up, I was just a user. Then I became the person who created content, not only for myself, but for brands. And then it was quite interesting to be on the place when you're just creating and you know for what are you doing this. And then this interplay of feelings inside me really made me quite perplexed and question if I want to go in the direction of marketing further, especially digital marketing. Also, I worked directly with TikTok when it was on its rise after the COVID. And then you know how it works, and then you optimize the content. Also, we just knew the stats. You can't create the video like it was on YouTube for an hour. You have to create something, not even 60 seconds, 7. On the first two, you have to catch the user. And then you create the content based on that. And then you think, okay, as you mentioned before, Lisa, you just know how the product works, and then you can't go back. And I think that was the point when I also started questioning my relationships with social media. When I was taken off the plane, going on vacation to have a pause from the job And then I was still on the flight posting stories when my ex-partner told me, like, hey, can you like put it down? And I'm like, no, I have to do this. And then about the moment when I really reflected on it. And then I also went more into design, UX design, thinking how the products are created, because they're not just existing. They're created by humans like us. And then people like us can also influence the decisions either as a creators or policymakers or advisors or just being the part of the discussion. And then while doing presentations on option control, the first question I start them is this app feeding or eating you? And it really helps to set the room on this reflection point. So then for me as a digital native, as a millennial, Gen Z, social media are my home. It's a part of my identity. I know that the younger generations are all in TikTok and using that. And I was like, no. Leave me with my Instagram. This is where I am. This is my bedroom. So I keep using that for more self-expression, though I think I always was at the point where I tried to create more than to consume. But it really shifts on your mental state. When you are not socializing, when you are on your own, and that's the most vulnerable part for all the social media users, you go there to socialize, quote unquote, and then you're just drawn and you're being fed by stuff. And it eats you at some point.
Yeah, definitely. I'm off Instagram since a good year now. But it was a journey because I'm also a yoga teacher. And on Instagram, you reach a lot of people that are interested in that. So I always felt this, like I have to push content out so that people will find me. But I never really enjoyed it. I never really liked it. I felt I had to do it. And then I did this experiment. Told myself for 3 months I'll be off and I'll see if there's an impact on my classes, and there wasn't. So that was my sort of proof that I don't need to be on there if it doesn't feel right. I think there's a lot in this area as well, reflecting, experimenting, trying to get off some of these networks for a while and see what it does to you, how it impacts your life. But to come back to the societal or the more like systemic level, right, which is what you're trying to achieve with Sparkable as well. How do you think Sparkable will develop into the future, and what do you need to achieve your mission?
Yeah, I mean, we're developing slowly at the moment, and we wish we could be faster because there's a great sense of urgency that we all feel. The biggest thing in terms of like, if you want to get involved in helping us build that platform is to join the team and volunteer in our team. And then there's also more lighter touch ways to be involved, which would be sort of joining either one of our events, we do offline events as well, or to just create an account on Sparkable and post on Sparkable and give us feedback. So we do have a research team, and we call it a community consultation that we're doing at the moment, where we're asking community members about their experience and what they would like to change and improve about the platform. So I think that's sort of the main ways that we would love people to contribute to Sparkable. And then the vision or the goal is definitely to make our impact bigger. And that means, building the platform in a way that it really can do the things we say we want to do. So for example, bridging based ranking is still something we're implementing. There's, the transparency and user control part. There's so many parts of the pro-social design that we're still working on. So it's a lot of things in the pipeline.
We're now going to go into the last part of the conversation. Are you ready for the rapid fire questions?
Sure.
All right. So rapid fire means quick, short answers. I know this is tricky, but I'll start with the first question, which is, Vardon, if you could rewrite a line of code in any product of your choice, what would it be?
It's probably more than a line of code, but it would be changing what the algorithm optimizes on or for, and changing away from engagement to bridging. So making sure the algorithms on social media optimize for content that bridges divides.
Perfect. All right. The next one is on allyship. What is one everyday act of allyship that anyone can do?
For me, it would be if you're in a room where decisions are made and you realize that there are people who should be in that room who are not, like, speak up and make sure the decision is only made with the people who are also gonna, you know, be affected by the decision. I think that is what I would say.
Yeah, Vardner replied, on the structural level, I would go back to individual. I would say respect people's attention in any role that you have. If you are sitting at a table with person with whom you're having a meal, put the phone down or away, because this person is literally sitting next to you. It's the luxury of the world we're living right now to have this offline communications. And on the other side, also, while you're communicating with anyone, instead of sending 5 3-second voices, write a text, dictate a text, respect people's time.
I think we could make a whole podcast about voice messages. Yes, awesome. Okay, next one is, and Vardon, you touched a little bit on that already, whose voices do you think tech especially needs to hear more from?
Yeah, I definitely think it's the people who are basically suffering from the harm that tech is creating. And that is also like central part of our approach at Sparkable is, you know, if we want to build healthier tech, we need to have the people building it, people who have knowledge about the harms that we see today. So, for example, you know, it could be a person who has worked as a content moderator for one of the biggest social media platforms and has seen sort of, you know, what that work looks like and knows the importance of keeping people safe. And then, you know, having that person be, for example, the one building the policies instead of the policies being, you know, coming from, I don't know, a group of people in Silicon Valley.
Very nice. We're going to end with the question. If listeners remember just one thing from this whole conversation, what should it be in your opinion?
My answer would be that you are not just addicted or weak. This was designed to be this way and to serve your human nature. And in the end, you are not the only one responsible for your habits, but you can also build them yourself. So in the end, understanding that's not only your fault to have these patterns that you're not satisfied with or ways that you're communicating or using the tech, but in the end, understand that you can create your own intentional ways of creating these habits as itself. And you could be the change maker by either changing your habits and giving the example for the people around you, educating the other generations or people around you, going to volunteer or to spread the word. And in the end, understanding that we're living in a democratic society where the voice of the people should be the one that creates the policies.
Yeah, building on what you said, Sophia, I think for me, the key takeaway or the most important message is that there's so much going wrong, right? And I think we're all tired of reading the news and, you know, knowing about the things that are bad. But there's at the same time also so many good things happening, or so many people, groups, organizations, you know, working on positive change, working to build healthier technology. It's sometimes a bit harder to find that because obviously, you know, media and social media is not optimizing to show those. But if you make a little bit of that effort, and I think listening to that podcast would be a first step, then you find amazing people and teams and groups, and, you know, do reach out, do join them, do just like whatever you can to be a part of that positive change, because we oftentimes are left, you know, feeling very doomed. Yeah, but it shouldn't be this way. We all have agency, and when we come together, like, we're way more powerful than we think. And so let's do that, and let's, you know, join forces in a sense to really build a world that is better than what we have today.
It's not only doom and gloom, there are also the things that spark joy, like Sparkable.
Perfect. Yeah, and that's also exactly why we do this podcast and why we love talking to people like you, showing the positive sides and showing how we can build healthier tech. And with that, we'll end this wonderful conversation. Thank you so much, Vardon and Sophia, for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you, Lisa.
A
another very insightful discussion, and I'm happy to share what stuck with me. The first thing that I found very interesting is that with Sparkable, they're building a community of change makers, and that especially the younger generations, both the Gen Z but also millennials, they are really feeling that social responsibility to build tech in a more healthy way for other generations as well. Being aware of the interaction patterns is the second thing that stuck with me, and that by observing our own habits and becoming aware of what they do to us, to the way we interact with social media, but also other tech tools, can really make an impact on your own life. But we don't only have to change things on the individual level. It's also important to address the structural level, that tech is built in a healthier way and not incentivized to keep us all on these platforms for too long. In the show notes, you can learn more about Vardon and Sophia's work at Sparkable and with the Option Control project. And if you have a friend or someone at work that should listen into this conversation, we'd appreciate it if you forward them this episode. And then the last thing, something to think about for this week. How are you making use of social media? Are you making it intentional, or are you just doom scrolling all day long? We'd love to hear your thoughts.